and turn things over to your first speaker, Emmy Leiha from EPA's Federal Facilities Office, to provide a brief introduction to this series. Emmy, are you ready to begin?
Sure. Thanks for a moment before we delve into today's topic, but we wanted to talk a little bit about the Federal Facilities Academy. So this is a voluntary training program developed for EPA remedial project managers from other federal agencies, our state counterparts, and tribal groups who work on federal facility Superfund cleanups. The Academy is made up of 12 courses total. 11 of those are webinars, one of which you're participating in today, so thank you for being here. And the 12th course is an in-person training. So we had two of these scheduled on trainex.org on upcoming courses, but with everything that's going on in the beginning of this year, we're going to have to reschedule those. As soon as those dates are available, they'll be posted on the Trainex website. I know we had a few questions of people asking what dates those were going to be rescheduled for, and we haven't finalized new dates yet. But as soon as we do have those for the one in-person training course, which is a three-day course, we'll definitely post that so people can sign up and register. So though this is a voluntary training, the whole point of encouraging people to participate is really to help get into the nuances of federal facility cleanups, because it's a little bit different. Some of our challenges are different, and the types of discussions we have with each other are different. So these 11 webinars are really trying to get more at those types of challenges that we experience at federal facilities. If you've missed a course that's already delivered, but you would be interested in taking that, as Jean mentioned, everything is archived, so you can access it in the future, access it at a later time, and still get your certificate of completion for that course. And if you complete all of the courses, all 12, then you'll get a certificate of completion for the program from our EPA Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, which is the office I work in. It's CIFRO for short, for our Federal Facilities Program. So I'll hand it back over to you, Jean.
Okay, so just quickly to reinforce what Emmy has highlighted, this whole series is combined of a combination of online courses, which are open to the public, and classroom sessions, which will have a limited audience that have yet to be rescheduled. So for your online webinars, just like today's session, you can participate either taking them live or replaying the recorded or archived versions. And again, these sessions are open to the public. For that in-person classroom training, when it is rescheduled, you'll have to attend it in person, and it will be open to a limited audience, as Emmy highlighted. In order to receive credit, you can get credit for each of the individual webinars by either attending them live or replaying the recorded versions and then submitting feedback for each one of these webinars. You'll get a certificate for each one. To get an Academy certificate for the entire series, in addition to completing all of the online ones and sharing feedback for each one, you'll then also have to take that in-person delivery, and then upon completing that, you'll then get a certificate for the entire series. And so with that sort of brief summary, let me go ahead and call up your presentation materials, and we can get started with our session.
And Jean, while that's coming up on the screen, I'll just let people know, if you need help keeping track of when you've taken courses, particularly if you're taking them from an archived version, we do have a nifty little tracker that's on the seminar resources page that you can click and download, plug in the date you took your training, and then you'll have that as a reference if you're going to ask for that overall certificate of completion once you've done them all. Just a plug for those documents. All right, it looks like our slides have come up, so we can go ahead and get started with today's topic. And today we're looking at determining applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, ARARs, at federal facility sites. Clicking over to the next slide here. So before we jump into all of the content we have for you today, we want to get a better sense of who's joining us through a group poll. And we, the instructors, Betsy and myself, would like to get a better idea of what experience you've had with ARARs in a decision document at a federal facility. Jean, would you take them through the poll?
Sure. So in the lower left corner of your screen, a new window will have popped up, which will allow you to type in your own response to the question. What experience have you had with ARARs in decision documents at a federal facility? As participants in today's course enter their responses, you'll start to see them appear in the screen above. But if you've had the same experience, hover your cursor over the entry, and you'll notice a plus one appear just to the right of that entry. You can click the plus one to agree or vote for that response. And this handy tool will help us see which one of the experiences amongst all of those entries are common across our participants. And Emmy, as I'm looking at some of these responses, it seems like one of the most common one is that they have no experience in a
right
decision document. So they're new to the topic, but we do have a mixture of other experiences. So what are some other common ones that you're seeing in the queue?
It looks like some people have experience when they're looking at maybe an older record of decision and they have to go back and figure out why an ARAR was chosen or why it was not included. So trying to figure out, you know, through existing documentation how they got to that list of ARARs. I can see how that could be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'm seeing, or for those who have some, it's very limited experience that they've had, or trying to identify both state and federal ARARs.
Yeah, and an answer to that, the question about why everything is not included in the past, it's basically an evolving body of information. We're constantly getting smarter about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Okay, well, this is really helpful. It seems like Jean mentioned there's some people who don't have a lot of experience, so this is a great place to get some and start getting a better understanding of ARARs, and maybe we can answer some of the questions that you have. One last check-in I want to do with the group. If you look at your screen over the slide, there's a little icon of a person raising their hand. If you click on the down arrow there, I'd like to ask a quick question. How many people on the call have downloaded the slides, what we refer to as the participant manual, to help as you go through this course today? If you downloaded it, could you click the agree button? And if you haven't, if you could click the red X for disagree. And that'll just give us a quick sense of who's making use of those resources. We try to provide that. It's the slides complete with detailed notes, so you don't have to try and write everything down as we're going through the course. And you can use it as a source or a reference materials in the future. And again, if you don't have that downloaded but you want to download it, you can do that right now by going through the seminar resources link and downloading that, either now or later. That'll remain available for you all. Okay, and once we're, you can go ahead and clear your status using that same process. And we'll continue on. I'll hand it over to Betsy to take us or get started on today's slide.
Okay, thanks, Emmy. Sorry. I'm having just a little technical issue myself, and I've got it figured out. Okay, good morning or afternoon, I guess. It depends where you are, right? For me, it's afternoon. This module is going to provide an overview of applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements known as ARARs, which are described under Section 121D of the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act of 1980, or CERCLA, and further explained in EPA guidance. The goal of this course is for you to first understand the two categories of ARARs, which are applicable and relevant and appropriate, and also the category of to-be-considered criteria, or TBCs. Also to become familiar with the three types of ARARs and how they are determined, including chemical-specific, location-specific, and action-specific, to understand the difference between substantive requirements, and which must be met on-site, and administrative requirements, which are not required to be met on-site, to learn how to document ARARs, particularly in the record of decision, to learn the general procedure for identifying and analyzing ARARs, which basically is your biggest hurdle, and finally, to become familiar with the six ARAR waivers, which are identified in CERCLA Section 121D, which allow you to not comply with an identified ARAR at a site. Okay. So we'll start with ARARs and TBCs. Why are ARARs necessary? CERCLA was enacted to address abandoned, uncontrolled hazardous waste sites. So cleanup of these sites is conducted either through urgent short-term removal actions or through longer-term remedial actions, or a combination of both with removal and a follow-on remedial action. Congress gave the President the authority under CERCLA to select and carry out these cleanup actions without applying for permits required under other federal or state statutes or regulatory programs for activities conducted on sites which would otherwise require a permit. Their intent was to avoid lengthy application periods and the imposition of application fees in order to streamline and expedite the cleanup process at CERCLA sites. However, Congress still wanted CERCLA cleanups to achieve applicable standards in order to ensure that the remedies implemented would be protective of human health and the environment. So here's starting with the overview. This section covers how ARARs and TBCs materials are identified under CERCLA, the National Contingency Plan, or NCP, and EPA guidance for cleanups of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants addressed under CERCLA. On-site cleanup, CERCLA cleanups must attain or waive ARARs. And since some of those ARARs will address the how-to of implementing a remedy, those ARARs should be complied with during the implementation phase of a remedial action. So what are the universe of ARARs? Specifically, CERCLA Section 121D requires that on-site remedial actions attain or waive federal environmental laws or more stringent state environmental or facility siting laws that are determined to be ARARs. There are six statutory ARAR waivers that Emmy is going to address later in the program. Additionally, the NCP requires compliance with ARARs during removal actions to the extent practicable. And right here, I just want to point out that there's a minor error in the participant manual where it states that, quote, removal and remedial actions must comply with ARRs to the extent practicable, end quote. That statement should only reference removal actions. Again, remedial actions must attain or waive ARRs. So given the requirement to achieve ARRs, identification and determination of state and federal ARRs is a fundamental component of remedy decision, remedy selection. And generally, only federal or more stringent state standards are ARRs, but not local requirements. However, one limited exception when local requirements can be ARRs is under the Clean Water Act Pretreatment Program, where the local requirements may be incorporated into and enforced under an NPDES permit issued to an industrial user by the state or EPA. Most other types of local ordinances are not ARRs. The main source of ARRs will generally be federal laws and regulations. Let's look at when state requirements can be ARRs. The NCP states that only those state standards that are promulgated, are identified by the state in a timely manner, and are more stringent than federal requirements may be applicable or relevant and appropriate. For purposes of identification and notification of promulgated state standards, the term promulgated means that the standards are of general applicability and legally enforceable. State laws that are promulgated must be enforceable. That is, generally, they must contain specific enforcement provisions, and they must be consistently applied in similar situations across the state. This latter requirement reflects one of the potential ARRR waivers we'll talk about later, which is when the reverse is true and the state requirement is not consistently applied. So for example, if a state requirement has been proposed, but the law or regulation has not yet been adopted, then the proposed requirement cannot be an ARRR, even if it is more stringent than its federal counterpart. However, it could be determined to be a TBC, which we'll look at next. One thing to note is that under RCRA state hazardous waste programs that have been authorized to operate in lieu of the federal program become the federally enforceable program. Technically speaking, in this instance, the state regulations are actually federal ARRs, but that's a bit arcane. So, to be considered requirements, TBCs are non-promulgated advisories or guidance issued by federal or state government that are not legally binding and do not have the status of potential ARRs. Additionally, as I just mentioned, proposed regulations that have not yet been adopted can also be TBCs. TBCs are considered along with potential ARRs during the RIFS stage, including in the development of the risk assessment, especially when ARRs do not exist for particular contaminants, to help determine the necessary level of cleanup at a site to protect human health and the environment. PBCs should be included in the ROD when they are necessary to interpret ARRs or to determine preliminary remediation goals. Once a remedial action is selected in the ROD, the so-called TBCs will already have been considered and either determined to be appropriate to apply to the remedy or discarded as inappropriate. At that point, they're incorporated into the performance standards in the ROD and must be complied with just like ARRs. Although they're still referred to as TBCs because that's the name they got stuck with, the fact is they have been considered and are being applied to the site cleanup. A common misunderstanding about TBCs is that they are still just optional, even when selected in a ROD. It's in the name, right? But think of it like if you had a friend who was small when he was little and he was nicknamed Shorty. And then even after he has a growth spurt and he grows up, they still call him Shorty. It's kind of the same thing with TBCs. Remember that if they've been selected in a ROD, they must be complied with just like ARRs. Another misunderstanding about TBCs that I want to dispel is the idea that a promulgated federal or state requirement that you're not sure should apply to a remedial action at a site could be listed as a TBC. No, that is not the case. A promulgated federal or state regulation can never be a TBC. It's either applicable, relevant and appropriate, or it's nothing vis-a-vis the site. An example of this might be if there's a possibility that there's a particular endangered species that might nest at your site, and you're thinking, I don't know if that species is there, so maybe I should just cite the Endangered Species Act as a TBC. Well, that's just not the case. If you're pretty sure, you know, you think it might be there, you're pretty sure, you cite the Endangered Species Act as an ARR because it's applicable if the species shows up and builds a nest. It's not a TBC. Now, if there's a local ordinance that you feel would be useful to consider in your remedy, then that could be cited as a TBC, since generally only federal and state regulations can be ARRs. Now, turning back to ARRs, let's look at the identification process. Identification of ARRs must be done on a site-specific basis involving a two-part analysis. First, a determination of whether a given requirement is applicable. Then, if it is not applicable, a determination of whether it is nevertheless both relevant and appropriate. A requirement may be either applicable or relevant and appropriate, but not both. ARRs are based on the circumstances of the site, the substances found there, the location of the site, and the actions that will be taken to carry out the remedy. And we'll talk about these later in more detail. And Emmy will also talk about the three types of ARRs that address these circumstances in the next segment. It's important to consider ARRs early in the CERCLE process, since the need to address a specific ARR regarding a particular contaminant found at the site could determine the sampling approach, the analytical method used, or the analytical detection limits that must be achieved during the remedial investigation. We've been talking about ARRs generally. Let's break them down. First, applicable requirements. EPA's ARRs guidance, the CERCLA Compliance with Other Laws Manual from 1988, which we still use for the most part, states that applicable requirements are those cleanup standards of control, and other substantive environmental protection requirements, criteria, or limitations promulgated under federal or state law that specifically address a hazardous substance, pollutant, contaminant, remedial actions, location, or other circumstance at a CERCLA site. If a requirement is deemed applicable, all substantive portions of that requirement apply. In order to directly apply to the situation, the specific terms or jurisdictional prerequisites of the law must be met. Your participant manual highlights the sections of the NCP where state involvement with the lead federal agency is required in the identification of ARRs. Another important point is that you should involve your legal counsel in the discussion of potential ARRs early in the ARR identification process, because they'll come and tell you something's all wrong and you've got an agreement. It just doesn't fly very well. So turning to relevant and appropriate requirements, again, from the Compliance with Other Laws Manual, relevant and appropriate requirements are those cleanup standards, standards of control, and other substantive environmental protection requirements, criteria, or limitations promulgated under federal or state law that while not applicable to the hazardous substance, pollutant, contaminant, remedial action, location, or other circumstance at a CERCLA site, address problems or situations sufficiently similar to those encountered at the CERCLA site that their use is well suited to the particular site. The example in the blue box on your slide refers to maximum contaminant levels under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which apply to drinking water provided at the tap. However, MCLs and non-zero MCLGs, the GOLs, are specifically made relevant and appropriate to groundwater cleanups by CERCLA Section 121D2A. So if you have MCLs that you want to apply to your site groundwater cleanup, then you know that they'll be relevant and appropriate. When analyzing relevant and appropriate requirements, the determination considers both aspects. First, is it relevant? And second, is it appropriate? In general, determining relevant and appropriate requirements involves a comparison of a number of site-specific factors with those addressed in the statutory or regulatory requirement, including the characteristics of the remedial action, the hazardous substances present at the site, or the physical circumstances of the site. This analysis is largely based on professional judgment. In some cases, a requirement may be relevant but not appropriate, given the site-specific circumstances. Such a requirement would not be an AR for your site. In addition, there is more discretion in the determination of relevant and appropriate. It is possible for only part of a requirement to be considered relevant and appropriate in a given case. For example, RCRA closure regulations specifying requirements for capping a landfill could be determined to be relevant and appropriate to put to the placement of a cap over a dump that was never permitted as a landfill. This does not mean that all landfill requirements will apply to this situation, because it's likely that it's not going to be appropriate to dig up all the waste in place to install a liner underneath it. When the analysis results in the determination that the requirement is both relevant and appropriate, such requirement must be complied with to the same degree as if it were applicable. So here are the 8 site-specific factors that in the NCP to use to compare the circumstances at your site to the requirement in question to see whether it's relevant and appropriate. So let's just run through them. Let me see if I can do this cursor thing. No, okay. One, the purpose of the requirement and the purpose of the CERCLA action. For example, the capping of an unpermitted dump, as I just discussed. The purpose would be to prevent exposures and to limit infiltration of rainwater through the waste and into the groundwater, similar to the purpose of the RCRA capping requirement. Second, the medium regulated or affected by the requirement and the medium contaminated or affected at the CERCLA site. For example, the use of MCLs as cleanup goals for contaminants in groundwater, which is a potential source of drinking water, and the use of MCLs to regulate contaminants in drinking water under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Both address water, the same medium. Third, the substances regulated by the requirement and the substance is found at the CERCLA site. And the prior example works well for this as well. When the MCL addressing a particular contaminant potentially present in the drinking water source under the Safe Drinking Water Act is used as the remedial goal for that same contaminant in the groundwater cleanup. Fourth, the actions or activities regulated by the requirement and the remedial action contemplated at the CERCLA site. Again, the capping of the landfill is essentially the same activity as the capping of an unpermitted dump. So RCRA capping regulations would be relevant and appropriate. Any variances, waivers, or exemptions of the requirement and their availability for the circumstances at the CERCLA site. Six, the type of place regulated and the type of place affected by the release or CERCLA action. The type and size of structure or facility regulated and the type or size of structure or facility affected by the release or contemplated by the CERCLA action. An example of this might be if there are air regulations that apply to facilities with a certain level of emissions, those could be relevant and appropriate to treatment facilities constructed at the site. And finally, any consideration of use or potential use of affected resources in the requirement and the use or potential use of the affected resource at the CERCLA site. Again, groundwater that is a potential source of drinking water, and the Safe Drinking Water Act regulates drinking water, focusing on the same resource. So these won't all make sense in every circumstance, but they provide a framework for your consideration of the status of the requirement. Now, that is, you know, that, and Jean, can you run them through this poll?
Absolutely. So there's now a new question that's appeared at the bottom half of your screen, asking which of the following is not true of a TBC. Is it A, it is promulgated, B, it is not promulgated, C, it is considered in determining a remedy's protectiveness, or D, it can help determine preliminary remediation goals? So we want to sort of check off and indicate which ones you think are not true of a TBC. And I'm looking at a bunch of these votes coming in. It seems like the audience has kind of sort of settled in here on A, that it is promulgated, that that is not true. Elizabeth, or can we talk through what the correct answer is?
Yeah, sure. So the correct answer is, in fact, A, which it's a little, that sounds counterintuitive, I guess, but the, you know, the question's in the negative. So which of the following is not true of a TBC? The statement that it is promulgated. That is not true because a TBC, by definition, is guidance or draft legislation or anything but a promulgated regulation. So A is correct.
And on the same note, all the other items listed up there are true of a TBC, right? That it's considered in determining a remedy's protectiveness, and it can help determine preliminary remediation goals in some cases. Is that right, Betsy?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Hey, Betsy, we had a question. Could you take a second to introduce yourself and a little bit about what you do for EPA?
Sure. I have been working basically my whole career as an attorney at EPA in EPA Region 3 in Philadelphia. I am currently on a six-month detail to the Federal Facility Enforcement Office at headquarters, working as a senior counsel there. But I started out in the water branch in the Office of Regional Counsel in Region 3, and I worked with them for about 6 years, and then I transitioned to Superfund and worked in private removal and remedial branches, and then I guess in the late 90s maybe, transitioned into doing federal facility work as well as private work. So in the region, my caseload is about 50-50 private site, Superfund sites and federal facilities. And then I also have a smattering of other administrative cases in there, EPCRA and oil pollution, that sort of thing. So.
Awesome. Thanks, Betsy.
Thanks for asking.
Right. I know we kind of jumped into it and didn't introduce ourselves, but now we know each other a little better, so that's great. We're going to continue on into the next section of our presentation, which is looking at the types of ARARs. So there are three different types, chemical-specific, location-specific, and action-specific. And we'll look into each of these in more detail, but just to give you an overview, we have our chemical-specific and location-specific ARARs, which are typically identified early in the CERCLA process during the site investigation. Your chemical ARARs are usually health or risk-based numerical values, while the location-specific ARARs depend on the where. Where is your site located, and what is the action taking place? With your action-specific ARARs, those are usually identified once you know what alternatives you're considering at the site, because you have to know what actions you're considering taking. So those would be identified during your feasibility study. But let's go into all of these with a little more detail, starting with chemical-specific ARARs. So as I mentioned, they're usually health or risk-based numerical values or methodologies that result in the establishment of numerical values when applied to site-specific conditions. So these values establish the acceptable amount or concentration of a chemical that can be found in or discharged to the ambient environment. We have an example here with MCL, maximum contaminant levels, that are standards identified under the drinking water quality under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And these are usually expressed as a concentration, like milligrams per liter, micrograms per liter, and they are health-based. So you'll have MCLs for things like nitrate or cyanide, chromium. Many of you are probably very familiar with what the MCLs I'm referring to. And if a chemical has more than one ARAR, or more than one requirement, generally the more stringent one will be used. So just something to keep in mind. So that's a chemical-specific ARAR. We have an example to share from a real record of decision for groundwater. This was from the Travis Air Force Base ROD issued in 2014. So the table that you're seeing on this slide is, if you've done this before, it probably looks familiar. A table is usually what's suggested to be able to display all of the ARARs in your record of decision. So this is a chemical-specific ARARs table for this record of decision. And you'll see that it is citing the Safe Drinking Water Act highlighted in, oh, let me get my little arrow here. One second. Jean, can you help me pull up that arrow? Thank you. So we have the Safe Drinking Water Act that's cited. And here under the ARAR determination, you'll note that it's identified as relevant and appropriate. And this is for this regulation that addresses drinking water-based cleanup goals for groundwater plumes. And so they have in the comments section a little description or additional details other than the description provided here. But what I was just trying to highlight is these are chemical-specific ARARs, the citation of the regulation here, and then its determination as being relevant and appropriate. So hopefully that real ROD example is helpful to you. We also have an example here, again, of a chemical-specific ARAR that is, the requirement is coming from the Sources of Drinking Water policy. So this is the state's policy noted right here. It is a state requirement. And as far as the ARAR determination, this is identified as a TBC. All right. So some examples there of chemical-specific requirements. But now let's look at action-specific requirements. So these are usually technology or activity-based requirements or limitations, and they determine how a remedial alternative must be achieved. So you'll have specific requirements if you're considering things like air stripping or capping or injection of treated groundwater, excavation. Each of those actions are going to trigger particular requirements that would apply. That would be those remedial activities selected to accomplish a remedy. So for example, under RCRA, which is directed towards the hazardous waste management, it often provides the largest number of action-specific requirements because of that. So here's an example. Again, we're looking at the same 2014 groundwater ROD, and this is for action-specific ARARs. And the requirement is referring to effluent requirements for discharges to surface water. That's identified as a federal requirement. You see the specific citation. And with your citations, you want to get as specific as possible. You're not going to just cite the Clean Water Act or what have you. You want to get into the specific parts that apply. It's going to make it easier to ensure that you are, in fact, complying with those ARARs and that you're not adding other requirements unnecessarily. In this case, this is determined to be applicable. And if you look, I know the text is a little hard to read, but in the description it says that this is applicable at all sites where there will be discharge of extracted or treated groundwater to surface water via the storm water system or to Union Creek. So that more general description and then in combination with the comments that can provide more site-specific information are really helpful to understanding how this applies and how it's expected to be met with or complied with, excuse me. Okay. Moving on to location-specific requirements. So when you think about it, location is fundamental to determining what kind of impact the site is going to have on human health and the environment, right? If it's located, the site is located in an area far away from human and animal receptors, well, that's going to make a difference as compared to if it's right next to a housing development or a source of drinking water. So location is really important. And these types of requirements are restrictions placed on the concentration of hazardous substances or the kinds of activities solely because they occur in special locations. So another thing to consider, it's more, I guess you could say it's easy to understand a concentration limit, right? What's the number? What are we dealing with? But when you have something that's a narrative requirement, that can be a little bit harder to comply with. It might be a little bit more subjective. That's when consultation with other agencies who have expertise on those type of requirements is really important, because that will help ensure compliance with those ARARs to make sure their intent are fully understood and that the cleanup that you're looking at will in fact comply with those ARARs. So some examples, if there are activities that are going to take place in a floodplain or a wetland, historic places or other like sensitive ecosystems or habitats, then that's going to trigger these type of location-specific requirements. So here's an example on the next slide. Again, in our table, this is looking at location-specific ARARs. The requirement is for the Endangered Species Act. This is identified as a federal requirement. And here the ARAR determination is that it is applicable. And I know, again, this is a little hard to read, but I'll read you a little excerpt. Activities at remedial sites must be performed to identify and protect endangered or threatened plants and animals. So that requires an action to conserve those endangered species and their critical habitat. So that means that the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, is applicable for this cleanup action. Another thing to keep in mind when determining ARARs for a federal facility, and really for any record of decision that's moving forward for cleanup under CERCLA, is that it's a combined effort, particularly for federal facility sites that have a federal facility agreement in place. You want to be working with your counterparts. The state has a responsibility to identify state ARARs that apply. The federal agencies also need to identify those ARARs. And it's not a one and done. As we pointed out, there's some ARARs that can be identified earlier in the process during the site investigation, and others, like the action-specific ones, that will come later once you're looking at your cleanup alternatives. But even then, it is pretty much an iterative process of looking at these, working with your legal counsel, and making sure that you're starting early and refining your list of ARARs as needed throughout the process. And you want to identify ARARs that are pertinent to the characteristics of the site, the substances present, and the potential remedial action alternatives. A lot of times we get this request of EPA, like, well, just tell us what we have to meet. What are the ARARs? Just tell us. But EPA cannot specify in advance which requirements will be ARARs for a site, particularly because situations change and that can be unpredictable, especially at CERCLA sites. And this is always going to be a site-specific determination. So there's no cheat sheet or answer sheet that EPA can provide in the beginning of the process. It really is a group effort to make sure that these ARARs are identified in a timely fashion and that clearly identified how to comply with them. And then once you go through that iterative process, starting from your site investigation all the way through to your remedy selection, that final list of ARARs will be captured in the record of decision. And we'll talk more about how to document that later in the presentation. So now we have another quiz, or apply your understanding slide, as we like to call it, to see if this is sinking in. In this example, you have a scenario. Say you're considering an in-situ groundwater remediation approach for your site. How would you label the state's water policy that the groundwater you're cleaning up is considered a potential source of drinking water? Is it A, B, C, or D? So we have answers coming in. We'll give people a few more seconds. I don't see anything coming in the lead quite yet, but we'll give you a few more seconds to determine if it would be a TBC, applicable, relevant and appropriate, or none of the above.
So All right, Emmy. I think they're starting to shake out on a general pattern of the distribution of answers here. It's kind of interesting. Should we take a look at what we think the answer is?
Sure. So the correct answer, remember, this is the state's water policy. So we would say the correct answer is a TDC, because the state's water policy is not promulgated, so it can't be applicable or relevant and appropriate. We had we were a bit across the board. Some people did select applicable and others did select relevant and appropriate. But the key thing here that we were trying to get you to remember is that TDCs are non-promulgated advisories or guidance, and they're not legally binding. So if it's a policy, would you consider a policy as being, you know, legally binding? Betsy, did you want to jump in on this explanation, or?
Yeah, I was just thinking, some statutes will say, like in the beginning, you know, the very first section would say something like, it is the policy of the state of blah, blah, to, you know, that our waters shall be maintained in the pristine blah, 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 you know. So actually, sometimes it's, you know, there's a, quote, policy statement at the beginning of a statute, and maybe some of the people who answered this had something like that in mind, depending on where they're from. So, you know, there can be something stated as a policy in a statute. In that case, it would be, you know, applicable if it was cited. But what we had in mind here, what I understood this example to incorporate, was a written, you know, a policy that was not part of a promulgated statute or regulation.
So right. So if you were confused and you want to, if that's what you thought and you want to just send us a little note that says, oh, maybe we need to specify in the question that it's not promulgated, or if you like the way the question was set up, that'll just help us improve it on the next offering that we have a question that really helps people apply what they're learning as we go. So, or you could also do that on your feedback form at the end of the course. But thank you for playing along. We appreciate it. I think these check-ins are good just to see how the conversation is going so far. But I think before we jump into our next section, Betsy, I know you're tackling the next section. Do we want to stop and see if any questions have come in that we should answer now?
Yeah, there are a number of questions that have come in. And one of the first ones are about territorial laws. So a number of people have asked if you could comment on how territorial laws, for example, Guam, would figure into the ARARS process.
Oh, wow. you know what? I'm going to just have to take that person, send me that in an email, and I'm going to follow up with it. Because, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is that sounds like it's often rolled in with a state, but I'm going to have to follow up and just make sure before I say that.
Okay. All right. How about this next question? Do ARARs apply in the SI in determining whether the site will go on to an RI or will get closed?
Do ARARs apply in the...
Yeah, and the SI, I'm assuming site investigation in determining whether the site will go on to a remedial, to an RI, or it just gets closed out.
Well, I guess if there was an ARAR, like an MCL, you know, that had to be met, then you'd know for sure, you know, if you were exceeding the level, that you can't just close it out. You've got to do something about the contamination in the groundwater. Generally,
I would say they could be considered, right? But we're really looking at risk and how much risk is posed by the site in determining if it should move beyond the site investigation. Is that an easier way to say it, Betsy?
Right. And then the other thing, I mean, the reason you're looking at ARARs in the FS is because you're, for all the different alternatives, you've got to figure out what the ARRs would be for those remedial alternatives that you're considering. And if there's an alternative that clearly isn't going to meet the ARRs that you sort of suss out and decide those are the ones that would apply to that alternative. And if it's not going to meet it, then you're not meeting one of the threshold criteria that must be met in order for an alternative to be chosen to, as the selected remedy. So that's the purpose of, you know, looking at the errors at that stage to see whether the remedial alternatives can survive because they comply.
Okay. Okay, and they were simply referencing because it talked about that on the slide. So I'm going to jump in here to another question that had come in earlier, looking for an example of something that is not applicable but is relevant and appropriate that is not statutorily designated, like in the MCL example that you gave earlier.
That's relevant and appropriate, you said, not applicable?
Yes. Yes, that is not statutorily designated.
Right. I mean, one of the examples I gave earlier was if there was a dump on a, you know, where there was a like historic dump, but it wasn't a landfill per se, and you want to cap it or something like that, you look to the RCRA regulations and you'll find whichever ones that seem relevant and appropriate, like the capping, but, you know, maybe not all of the requirements that would apply to a landfill if you were starting from scratch. Those would be relevant and appropriate. Does that satisfy the question?
I think so. And yes, the participant noted that you've answered it. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We have one other, a lot of questions. But one of these is sort of a baseline definition one here. And then I'll come back to this. But so somebody just wants to know if you can clarify the definition of a CERCLA site. And they want to know if CERCLA sites include those that are not on the NPL.
Yes. Well, right. The NPL is the list of sites that would be handled under, that could be handled using the money in the Superfund.
Okay.
Emmy, do you have more to say about that?
Sure. So National Priorities List or NPL sites, they're, as far as who the lead cleanup agency is at a federal facility and the role of the federal and state regulators, that will be different than at a non-NPL site, where typically the state will have the lead and EPA may not be as involved in the cleanup, say, through an FFA or something of that nature. So that may change the discussion or the feel of moving through that ABARS determination process. But as for a CERCLA cleanup, you still need to be able to comply with ABARS. Did I say that right, Betsy?
Yeah. Another thing, so like removal sites, you know, especially when they're just, when there's a sudden, you know, something is identified and there's a quick removal, that's under CERCLA. But it's not, you know, maybe later when you do further analysis of the area after you've done, you dealt with the immediate emergency, and then go back and figure out, wow, this really is a terrible site. Let's put it on the NPL. But, you know, before that, it was a CERCLA removal site. So, there are other categories of sites that are addressed under CERCLA that aren't on the NPL.
Okay. The other thing that I'm seeing a lot of questions about is things that are policy but not necessarily statute. And there seems to be a lot of confusion about policies and if they're legally enforceable and what if policy is not in the statute but it's considered practice of the state. Is that going to will that make it a TBC? So I don't know if you can sort of generally tackle this concept of policies and their legal enforceability or what might make a policy a TBC?
Well, any policy can be a TBC. That's within the realm of policy. TBCs are policies and things that are generally not enforceable. So if you have something that's enforceable, it's probably a regulation, I guess. I guess I'm not sure if I'm stepping on the right side of the fence here with the question. I'm not sure which part I'm answering. But if you have a requirement, we'll just call it that, that's enforceable, then that is likely going to be dealt with as an error. If it's a policy that's not enforceable, then it can still be a TBC if you, when you discuss the situation at the site and the contaminants present, and you say, boy, this policy is, would really help, you know, or to our, in the application of our remedy, then you can say, okay, fine, we're adopting it. And once you do, if you put it in the rod, it must be complied with. So it's just that when you're looking at ARARs, if you see things that are applicable, then you must comply with them. You don't have a choice. But with a TBC, it's not enforceable. You're not required to comply with it. But if you, you know, in your site team analyze it and say, oh, this is good, we really need to do this, and you put it in your rod, then it must be complied with. Does that answer?
Okay. We'll see. I'll just remind my audience that if you have follow-on questions or want additional clarification, please put it into the Q&A window. I think in the interest of time, we're at about 1:55 p.m. Eastern, so we've got just over an hour left. We'll carry on with the presentation, but we will pause again for additional Q&A time. So let us know if you have more questions on those or other areas, and I'll go ahead and turn it back to the speakers to carry on.
Okay. All right, let me just make sure I've got that. Whoops. The advance button. Okay, there we go. So once you've identified your applicable and your relevant appropriate requirements, the next step is to determine which parts of those requirements are substantive and therefore must be complied with at your site. And only those parts should be cited as ARARs in your proposed plan or ROD text and the ARARs table. Just recall when Emmy was showing you the slides of the ARARs table from the Travis Air Force Base ROD. I don't know if you could see closely, but the citations to the CFR were like, 40 CFR 141.61A, little a in parentheses, little one, little this, little that, is very, very specific. So, for example, that section is about the MCLs, and you don't want to cite every single one in that, even that section, because there may be like 15 and maybe only three of them are present at your site. You want to go right through with a fine-tooth comb and pick out the contaminant constituents that are present at your site. So you don't, you know, obligate yourself to do a lot of other testing and compliance that isn't necessary. And this is the point when it becomes important to distinguish between on-site activities, which are those activities that occur within the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action, like if you had to build a mini treatment plant to deal with groundwater that was pumped up and there was no location on the actual site to do that. You could do it right next door. The difference between on-site and off-site. Because on-site activities are required to comply only with substantive requirements of the ARAR, not the administrative requirements. Substantive requirements are those requirements that pertain directly to actions or conditions in the environment. An example of substantive requirements shown in these three blue boxes include, can I do this arrow thing? I'm not sure. There it is. Okay. All right. Include quantitative health or risk-based restrictions upon exposure to types of hazardous substances, for example, MCLs, establishing cleanup standards for particular contaminants in groundwater, technology-based requirements for actions taken upon hazardous substances, for example, incinerator standards requiring particular destruction and removal efficiency, and finally, restrictions upon activities in certain special locations, for example, standards prohibiting certain types of facilities in floodplains. So if substantive requirements are the ones you want to keep, administrative requirements are the ones to cull out of your ARAR citation. Administrative requirements facilitate the implementation of the substantive requirements of a statute or regulation. They may include the need to obtain approval of or to have a consult with an administrative body. Disregard my little arrow there. the need to apply for permits, requirements for documentation, reporting, and record keeping, and specific enforcement requirements. In general, administrative requirements prescribe methods and procedures by which substantive requirements are made effective. While circle cleanups must comply with all the substantive requirements that would be contained in the permit, parties conducting on-site circle cleanups are not required to go through the process to obtain the actual permit papers. As highlighted in the green box, am I there? You can see it. As highlighted in the green box, remember that off-site activities must meet both substantive and administrative requirements of any applicable laws and regulations. One thing to note is that not all laws and regulations that might apply to a circle site will be treated as ARRs. In particular, OSHA regulations regarding safe work practices are not within the category of ARRs. They must be complied with in full, on-site, and off. Do not list them in your ARR table. While CERCLA Section 121 exempts lead agencies from obtaining federal, state, or local permits, or documents similar to permits, for on-site remedial activities, it's strongly recommended that the lead agency consult with other agencies, the ones that administer particular environmental statutes, for on-site actions affecting the same subject matter of the statutes. And here on the slide is a list of the most common statutes that address the situations you may encounter at your sites: National Historic Preservation Act, Archaeological and Historic Preservation Act, Endangered Species Act, Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. So, as an example, and not to belabor it, the Endangered Species Act requires federal agencies, in consultation with the Department of the Interior and the National Marine Fisheries Service as appropriate, to ensure that the actions they authorize, fund, or carry out are not likely to jeopardize the continued existence of endangered or threatened species, or adversely modify or destroy their critical habitats. So let's say you have a California condor, and it's critically endangered species, nesting at your site. You'll need to consult with DOI to determine when you may be able to conduct your remedial action and when you may need to pause activities so as not to disturb their nesting season. And your participant manual describes the consultation requirements of the other listed statutes in similar detail as well. So, Jean, we have another quiz.
We do. So there's now a new box that's going to appear in the lower half of your screen. And this time you have two boxes. And we've given you options to identify items A through E as either administrative or substantive. So simply check off the box to the left of the items that you think fall under each grouping or category. You don't have to worry, you're looking for a submit button. Literally just click the box and that kind of puts your vote in there. For those of you who have been nervous that you were being graded, you're not being graded. This is merely meant as an opportunity to demonstrate some knowledge and interact with our instructors in real time. So while you don't have to participate, we strongly encourage it. If anybody happens to be on a mobile device and you're unable to see those screens for any reason, you can also simply type in answers or comments into the Q&A window. I can see those as well. So things that are in the queue, I know some of you are resubmitting the same question over and over again. Please know that we have a lot of questions in the queue. There's about 280 people on live today. So just because I haven't quite read your question out loud yet doesn't mean that it's not there. We see you in the queue, and we're going to try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted today. All right. Well, Elizabeth, it looks like we've given the audience time, so I'm going to go ahead and broadcast the distribution of answers, and let's talk about the correct response.
Okay. So it looks like the majority of people that have answered this correctly, category, consultation with administrative bodies, definitely an administrative activity, although, as I said, it's important to do that, nonetheless, when you're dealing with one of those special statutes that is administrated by another federal agency. D, record-keeping processes, definitely administrative, and E, issuance of a permit, which is by statute not required at a circle site. So very good. And then on the substantive side, technology-based requirements, definitely substantive. So you have to comply with those when you're constructing your your treatment process on the site. Restrictions on activities in a floodplain, also substantive requirement, because that's absolutely necessary to protect the environment when you are carrying out a remedy that impinges on a floodplain. So looks pretty good. But do you think there are any other questions regarding that, or do you have any other thoughts about that, Emmy?
No, I think you covered it well.
Okay.
And I think it was answered well as, from our participants also.
Good job, everybody. So I guess we can proceed, right?
Yes.
My screen to pop back. Okay. All right. So documenting ARARs. ARARs are considered for each alternative in the detailed analysis of the alternatives, and they should be documented in detail in the RFS. The proposed plan and the LOD should explain in the text how the components of an alternative will comply with the major ARARs and should describe why the requirements are applicable or relevant and appropriate. And the LOD should document ARARs in the following sections. First, the major ARARs should be discussed in the description of the remedial alternative section. And I know that not everybody, but most people do a sort of similarities and differences of the alternatives before they get into the specific descriptions. And you can have, if all the alternatives have one ARAR in common that they have to meet, if it's a groundwater cleanup, an MCL, for example, but then different ways of approaching that cleanup may raise different remedial alternatives that bring with them different technical requirements, ARARs. So anyway, those are discussed in the description of the remedial alternative section. The second, the ARAR compliance should be summarized in the comparative analysis section. In the comparative analysis section runs through the 9 criteria in the NCP, and the first two criteria are the threshold criteria which must be met for a remedy to be selected, and those include overall protectiveness of the remedy and compliance of ARARs. So in that section, compliance of ARARs, you discuss the relative, the compliance with ARARs of the different remedial alternatives under consideration. Then finally, all of the ARARs selected for the remedy should be listed and briefly described in the statutory determination section. And mainly, this is done pretty much across the board by everyone. This reference can be made in this section to a table that sets forth all the ARARs, as the table that Emmy showed before. There, it's in detail. It states the source of the requirement, the specific citation, what the requirement, a description of what the requirement is, and then in the comments section, a description of how that requirement relates to the actual activity at the site. So that is a very detailed presentation of the ARARs, and that's in the statutory determination section, often as an appendix to the ARARs table. So please note, again, it is important to be as specific as possible in your citations and not to cite to entire parts of the CFR or even to entire sections, which may contain administrative requirements or other irrelevant requirements. In the case of a relevant and appropriate requirement that may not need to have every aspect of the regulation cited. Further, when an alternative is chosen that does not attain an ARAR, the basis for waiving the ARAR must be fully documented and explained. Emmy is going to go over the 6 statutory bases for waiving an ARAR later in the presentation. And TBCs selected in the ROD should also be listed and described briefly, as well as the reasons for their use. And they can be included in the ARARs table. So they're not ARARs. People like to have all of those requirements they're complying with in a handy, 3-page table. So just in that, as Emmy showed, in that table, in the category, you just write TBC. And again, that doesn't mean you're still considering it. It just means it didn't have the same authority initially as an AREA, but it is something you are now complying with because you've chosen it in your ROD. Generally, also, there's no need to document why a requirement that you listed initially in the FS is not an AREA eventually, although there should be documentation for both AREAs and TBCs if there's been a, you know, if the determination has been difficult or controversial. We've been talking about identifying AREAs generally and the fact that CERCLA requires their attainment for remedial actions. The NCP addresses AREAs in removal actions as follows. Removal actions must comply with AREAs to the extent practicable, considering the exigencies of the situation, and in determining whether compliance with AREAs is practicable, the lead agency may consider, first, the urgency of the situation, and second, the scope of the removal action. For example, to illustrate an urgent situation where a site contains leaking drums that pose a danger of fire or explosion in a residential area, the drums should be removed or stabilized immediately, of course, without attempting to identify and comply with all potential AREAs, which if you've done that, you know it's kind of a time-consuming process. The OSC's documentation should describe the time-critical nature of the situation and the remedial action that was taken, and that is documentation enough to justify not having to comply with AREAs. To illustrate the scope of a removal action to be taken, a removal action may be conducted to remove large numbers of leaking drums, as in the previous example, and associated contaminated soil. In that situation, because the removal focuses only on partial control of the site, just the soil and the drums, chemical-specific AREAs for groundwater restoration would not be considered, since contaminated groundwater would likely be addressed in a subsequent remedial action when AREAs would be required to be met. So we've talked extensively about the requirement for CERCLA response actions to comply with AREAs, but remember that there are two threshold criteria that must be met for the remedy to be selected. CERCLA Section 121 requires selection of a remedial action that is both protective of human health and the environment and that complies with AREAs. Both are threshold requirements that the remedial action must meet. EPA's approach to determining protective remedial goals includes the performance of risk assessments for human health and the environment, the analysis of AREAs that are established at levels deemed protective of human health or the environment, and consideration of TBCs. The risk assessment includes consideration of specific site-specific factors, such as the types of hazardous substances present, the potential for exposure, and the presence of sensitive populations. EPA's acceptable exposure levels are generally determined by application of AREAs and adherence to the following risk ranges or consideration of the following factors. For systemic toxicants, acceptable exposure levels shall represent concentration levels to which the human population could be exposed on a daily basis without risk of significant adverse effects during a lifetime. For known or suspected carcinogens, acceptable exposure levels, are generally concentration levels that represent an excess lifetime cancer risk that is above the normal national average, which is something like 1 in 3, from exposure to site-related contaminants of between 10 to the minus 4, 1 in 10,000, and 10 to the minus 6, 1 in a million. And in the event that there are multiple contaminants at a site or multiple exposure pathways, for example, via ingestion or inhalation or dermal contact, the 10 to the minus 6 risk level shall be used. In addition, there may be technical limitations, such as detection or quantification limits for contaminants that prevent the verification of the achievement of remedial goals established at lower levels. So, but you still probably want to set your goals that low, and eventually the technical quantification and you know, will catch up with it. So don't give up. Once you've established your protective levels, where are they required to be achieved? EPA's policy is to attain AREAs and TPCs necessary for protection to ensure protection at all points of potential exposure. At each potential exposure point, a reasonable maximum exposure scenario should be assumed. And cleanup goals set accordingly to ensure protectiveness using best judgment. Restrictions on use or access should not be substitute for remediation to appropriate protective health-based or design levels. Don't just put up a fence and a do not enter sign. And land use controls prohibiting groundwater use are not acceptable as a final remedy for groundwater. Remember that. Though they may be used in the interim to prevent exposure while the cleanup is underway. For example, if you're injecting something that's ameliorating the groundwater during that phase, 5 years or something, there could be a land use control for that portion of the plume. What does this mean, practically speaking, in terms of where remedial goals must be met? The groundwater, at the top of your slide, remediation levels should generally be attained through the contaminated plume. Or if there's a waste management area, such as a landfill, that will remain at the site, remediation levels should be attained at and beyond the edge of the waste management area. For surface waters, selected discharge levels should be attained at the point of discharge where the release enters the surface water. And for air, selected levels should be established for the maximum exposed individual, considering the reasonably expected use of the site and the surrounding area, for example, residential, industrial, or recreational. And for all of these various environmental media, over to the right here, a reasonable maximum exposure scenario should be assumed at each potential exposure point, not your average exposure, but a reasonable maximum exposure. And if you want to learn more about exposure point considerations and risk determination, please consider one of the trainings on risk analysis. I don't know if any of you have any other leads about that, or we can come back to that later, perhaps.
Yeah, let's come back to that later and see. A number of our courses have been postponed, but EPA does have risk assessment training that's a couple of days long that might be really useful for people who are interested in this topic.
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like we're ready to start in on our next section, which is on ARAR's identification and analysis. So I see this course built almost like an onion, where we're peeling back the layers and delving further and further into the content. So now we're getting into a lot of the how-to, now that we've established what ARARs are and some of the different terminology that's used. So now I'm on slide 38, and we're looking at coordination and consultation with other federal and state programs. So we did see in the chat that there was a couple of questions around consultation and coordination. So one thing I want to clarify, there was a question about whether or not tribal consultation is an ARAR. And quickly, I'll plug that we do have a course on tribal coordination at federal facilities if you want to get into all the details. But I'll just reference that there is an executive order, 13175, about consultation and coordination with Indian tribal governments. And an executive order essentially has the force of law. And that executive order states that executive departments and agencies are charged with engaging in regular and meaningful consultation and collaboration with tribal officials in development of any federal policies that have tribal implications. As well as respecting that government-to-government relationship that the U.S. has with Indian tribes. So starting with that executive order and then looking at CERCLA cleanups, if you have tribal groups that are impacted by the decisions that are taking place associated with this CERCLA cleanup, then the lead agency does have that obligation to consult with those tribes. So again, if you want to get into a lot more of the details, we do have a training dedicated to that topic, and it is archived if you'd like to access it and look more into those details. As far as,
just one thing I want to insert about that, that's great, and thank you for bringing that up. Executive orders, since at least for us who work in the federal government, that's an order from our boss. So we don't have the option to not comply with them. So they actually, we have to comply with them, so they can't be ARARs, because one of the features of an ARAR is that it is possible that it could be waived, as you'll find out later. And you can't waive one of your boss's orders. So that's just a parenthetical, but so it's good to know about that, and you must comply with it.
Oh, thank you for that clarification. That's important. But yes, it has to be done, essentially, I think is what we're trying to say. But when it comes to consulting with other groups, like this is the difference between thou shall, right, and you should, as in this would be helpful for you and might make your life easier. So we don't expect every individual to be an expert on all ARARs. And if you are, that's awesome. I myself am not. So when it makes sense to use that lifeline and call a friend or, you know, call one of your counterparts at another agency, they can help you with understanding those potential ARARs with other federal environmental laws administered by EPA. Say it's an authorized state program or another federal agency administered laws, or it could be more stringent state environmental or facility siting laws. So if you are not an expert in all these things, it would be really helpful to reach out to people who are experts in those different topics and coordinate with them to ensure that the remedies you're selecting will comply with the substantive aspects of identified ARARs. And reaching out to those other federal and state program offices would make a lot of sense. So highly recommended that you do that so you're not risking not complying with those ARARs or failing to identify all appropriate ARARs in your decision document. So keep that in mind. Okay, we'll go now to the next slide and look more in detail at where is the starting point. Okay, say you have a site and you're working through the CERCLA process and you're trying to identify some potential ARARs. Where do you start? Here are some specific requirements that you should consider. When it comes to chemical-specific ARARs, look at things like the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Maximum Contaminant Level Goals, or MCLGs. You know, these are usually relevant and appropriate at sites where you're looking at a groundwater cleanup. I say usually because everything is site-specific. Or you also have water quality criteria. And in these, you have to look at the designated uses of the water and the purposes for which the potential requirements are intended. For example, if you have water quality criteria as a component of your remedy for aquatic life, it may be relevant and appropriate when you have a cleanup goal for your CERCLA action that is to protect aquatic organisms. So you're, again, looking at how the water is designated and the purposes for the potential requirements that are intended. Next, we'll look a little more closely at action-specific ARARs to consider. Remember, these are usually technology or activity-based requirements. So some examples are RCRA closure requirements. If you're dealing with point source discharges, then you want to look at NPDES requirements or state regulations on toxic air contaminant discharges. So remember, your action-specific ARARs are going to indicate how a selective alternative must be achieved. So it depends on what you're looking at in that alternative. There's, if your alternatives are very different, then you'll have very different sets of requirements that apply to each. For example, in the green box here, if you're looking at air stripping, those requirements are going to be vastly different from what would be considered for capping or incineration or dredging and so on. So you get the idea. Next, we'll look at location-specific ARARs to consider, and these are restrictions of the concentration of hazardous substances or what activities you can conduct that are looking specifically at where a site is located. What is the location? So for that, we've mentioned already things like the Clean Water Act, RCRA location requirements, considering if you're doing anything with on-site storage, treatment, or disposal of hazardous waste, likely you're going to have to look at those RCRA location requirements. Or another example is the National Historic Preservation Act. If you have properties that are eligible to be on the National Register of Historic Places, likely those are going to be triggered when you're looking at cleanup alternatives for your site. So we started with giving you some starting points, but I'd like to get into the procedure for identifying ARARs, and is five steps identified on slide 42, and it's just This is a general procedure for identification and analysis of ARARs. The first one we just went over, identify your potential ARARs. We gave you some good starting points for that. Second, we're going to go over how to determine whether they are applicable. If not, you go to step three to determine whether they are relevant and appropriate. Then you finish off with steps four and five, which are to identify TBCs in addition to ARARs, and lastly, determine whether an ARAR waiver is justified. So let's go ahead and look at steps two and three in more detail. So we have two flowcharts, and these are taken right out of the Circle of Compliance with Other Laws manual. These are a little easier on the eye, I'll say. We just had to restructure them so they could fit on the slide, but it's still the same process that we use. So on this one, we start for, again, you're trying to determine if a requirement is applicable. And first, you look at the pertinent facts concerning the situation at the site or OU. As we've mentioned some of these before, what are the substances, the site or special location, who's impacted, what response action is being considered, and whatever other characteristics you need to consider. Then you're going to review and list the provisions of each potential applicable requirement. And we have a list of those factors here. What are the substances, the time period, be it facilities that are covered, who's impacted, and what the actions are. So you're going to take all that information and compare the pertinent facts about the chemicals present, the location of, and the types of action or technology under consideration at the site, and to make that comparison to the prerequisites for the requirement. Once you have all that information compiled, you're going to ask, are all pertinent provisions for requirements met? If your answer is yes, then that requirement is applicable. If your answer is no, you're not quite done yet, you need to go to the next procedure, which is step three, for determining if that requirement is relevant and appropriate. So when we say something is applicable, you might ask, like, well, what does that mean? I have to consider all this information, but what does applicable mean? So when you're trying to make this determination, think, does it directly and fully address the hazardous substance, pollutant, contaminant, action being taken, or other circumstances at the site? If it directly and fully addresses those things, then it's likely going to be an applicable requirement. But what if it's not? What if you have to go to step three, which is on the following slide, and try to determine if the requirement is relevant and appropriate? So here, again, we have another flowchart. And once you know something's not applicable, you want to look at another set of information to make this comparison. And you can disregard the red text on here. That's just a formatting issue. There's nothing particularly special about those items. So you're going to look at the factors relating to the origin and objective of the requirement in question. What are the specific goals and objective of that requirement? What substances are covered by it? What entities are affected by it? All this information listed here, I'll let you read through it yourself. So you'll look at that, and then you're going to look at the factors relating to the problem present at your site, your circle site or OU, that must be addressed by the remedial action. So what are the specific goals and objective of your remedial action? What media is contaminated? What substances are present at the site? What other circumstances do you have to consider as far as physical location, structures, and facilities involved? You're going to take all that information and refine the comparison considering the nature and character of the substances. What kind of contaminants are you dealing with? Is it VOC? Do you have NAPL? Is it radionuclides, heavy metals? Like, what are the nature and character of those substances, the characteristics of the site, the circumstances of the release, and the proposed response action? So you refine your comparison. Take all that information so you can ask yourself this question. Based on consideration of these factors, is a requirement both relevant and appropriate? So again, what does that mean? What does relevant and appropriate even mean? So when you're looking at relevance, you want to see if the requirement regulates or addresses situation sufficiently similar. So it maybe isn't directly addressing the requirement, but it is sufficiently similar to those at your CERCLA site. Then You want to see if it's appropriate to the circumstances of the release or the threatened release at your site, meaning that it's well-suited or that it's appropriate for it. So if you can say, based on all this information, if it's both relevant and appropriate, and your answer is yes, then you know that requirement is relevant and appropriate. If not, then it can go two ways. You might end up here. The requirement is simply not relevant and appropriate, and it's not, you shouldn't consider it further in the process. However, say instead of being really specific with your citation, you weren't as specific as you could be. Try to subdivide the requirements into smaller parts so you can conduct this analysis again and then determine if that smaller, you know, part of the requirement makes sense to include as being relevant and appropriate. Hopefully that helped understand how to determine what AROR you may be dealing with. So we have a quick apply your understanding to see if this is sinking in, and we have a little scenario playing out, and we're going to ask you two questions. So you can see in the scenario here, you have site X, and up on the right-hand corner, you'll notice you have some endangered species that have been found in the area. Then you also know that soil disturbing activities during the remedy implementation could impact the entire site. So given that setup, how should the Endangered Species Act be considered for this site? And we'll give you a second to answer, a few seconds, I guess. Okay, looks like a few people are still voting, but overall, I'll go ahead and, yeah, it seems like we're going to give people a few more seconds. Happy to see all the votes coming in. That's great. All right, looks like we're beginning to slow down. We can go ahead and show the results. So, to question number one, most people answered A, applicable. And if you answered A, you are correct. The Endangered Species Act should be considered as applicable for this site. Okay, now we're going to go into question two. So what kind of AROR should the Endangered Species Act be identified as? Definite trends coming out on this one. Give people a few more seconds. Okay, we'll go ahead and broadcast the results. And the answer to this question is B, location specific. And the majority of you did answer B to question number two. And remember, with the Endangered Species Act, we've talked about it quite a bit, but this is looking that activities at remedial sites must be performed to identify the presence of and to protect endangered and threatened plants or animals at the site. And it is all about the location. We showed in this little simplified scenario here that they are located on site, and that's when it would apply.
Yeah, and one thing, just, you know, for those of you who answered that it was action specific, there was a little trick in that slide because you've got the tractors moving the earth, and that is definitely, you know, whatever that is being done under is an action specific AROR, but but that was a little trick, and sorry if you got caught by it.
Thanks, Betsy. All right, so just in the interest of time, I would like to try and get through our last two sections on waivers and then post-ROD and what to do with AROR's post-ROD. So we'll go ahead, if that's okay, continue on to make sure we get through all of our content today. So we'll jump right into CERCLA AROR waivers. And the first question, when can CERCLA AROR waivers be invoked? So CERCLA Section 121D requires that on-site remedial actions attain or waive AROR's upon completion. And I believe we had a question as to what does on-site mean? So on-site is defined in 40 CFR 300.400E as the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action. So for example, say you have your operable unit and its boundary is defined, but within that boundary, you don't have enough space for a staging area where you need to stage all of the equipment that'll be necessary to implement your remedial action. You could argue that the staging area should also be considered on site for implementation of the response action. That's a quick example. So any off-site activities must comply with all applicable laws and regulations. The waiver would apply to on-site activities, not the off-site ones. And the statutory requirements to achieve protectiveness cannot be waived. That is, you can't opt out. That's never optional. The remedy still has to be protective. Also keep in mind that a waiver must be invoked for each AVAR that will not be attained. There's no catch-all waiver for multiple requirements. A waiver is necessary for each one. Let's talk briefly about documentation of AVAR waivers. So this also gets to the process. One step that has to be taken when pursuing an AVAR waiver is an opportunity for the public to comment on that waiver. So a circular proposed plan must provide a summary explanation of any proposed AVAR waiver. That proposed plan goes out for public comment. Then the public can request a meeting or a public meeting if there's significant interest. Then once that process is completed and any significant comments are responded to, the ROD must include the waiver invoked and an explanation, meaning its justification for that waiver. I think this usually comes as news to people who aren't familiar that public comment process is necessary. It's not just paperwork between agencies. It does have that other component to it. Also, in pursuing an AVAR waiver, it's likely that EPA headquarters is going to be heavily involved. But when we go over the six different types of waivers, we'll talk a little bit more about that. One more question I want to add. Say you have an old ROD and the remedy's been implemented, but years down the line, there's justification to move forward with an AVAR waiver. In that case, a ROD amendment would be required, and you would still need to go out with a proposed plan for the ROD amendment that explains the waiver being requested so that it can go out for public comment. So just a little bit on process there. On the next slide, we have a quick list of the CERCLA AVAR waivers. There are six of them. The first one for interim measures, I believe, is the most common, and there's typically little headquarters review. I caveat that because things have changed a little bit with now that decisions over $50 million need to go to the EPA administrator for consideration and possibly signature. So that's changed a bit, but you have interim measures. Compliance with AVARs poses a greater risk to health and the environment. Three, technical and practicability waivers. Four, equivalent standard of performance. Five, inconsistent application of state requirements. And the last one is a fund balancing waiver, but this does not apply to federal facility sites, so we're not going to go into that one in too much detail. So very quickly, we'd just like to get a sense of which waivers you have had experience with at your site from the six that we just went over. So we'll quickly put up a poll, and you can let us know what you've dealt with the most.
And this is one of those check all that apply style questions. So you'll see a box next to each option, and you can simply check each box if you've experienced or worked with these types of waivers. So you can check them all off if you've dealt with all of them or just a handful, whatever works. And again, for those of you who might be on a mobile device, feel free to type in answers into that Q&A window. You can see the options up on the slide, so you can just indicate by letter A, B, C, D, E, or F when entering in a statement.
So, Jean, I've had a bit of a connection loss, I think. Could you tell us what the survey said?
Absolutely. So it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have dealt with technical and practicability waivers, and then almost another two-thirds have dealt with interim measures. So those are the two big popular ones. but there is some limited experience, about 10%, with other things such as the greater risk to human health, the equivalent standard of performance, and then inconsistent application of state requirements.
Okay. Helpful. Thank you, everybody, for chiming in, letting us know what you have experience with. We will be going over all of these, except the fund balancing one, in more detail. So we'll go ahead and click over to slide 51 to talk about interim measures. And if Jean or someone could help me out with clicking through the slides, I'd appreciate that.
I'll click for you, Emmy. Go right ahead.
Thanks. All right. So an interim measures waiver can apply when the remedial action selected is only part of a total remedial action that will attain a such level or standard of control when completed. So, one, the final action must attain AROR compliance, so that's going to be the final action down the road, and also that interim measure may not cause or worsen problems at the site or hinder the final remedy in any way. So this interim measure is a really useful approach to move cleanup forward, and during the implementation of that interim measure, you can gather more information that'll help inform your final remedy for the site. So the example we have here is a groundwater alternative for hydraulic containment will not attain MCLs, but in this case, the MCLs are relevant and appropriate. In this interim measure, since it's interim, not final, those MCLs don't have to be met because there's going to be a future remedial action that will comply with all AROARs. Hopefully that was clear for people. Okay, let's go ahead to the next example, which is the greater risk waiver. And that one is looking at when compliance with such a requirement at the facility will result in greater risk to human health and the environment than the alternative options. So some things that have to be considered, you know, how significant are the risks? How long are they in duration with the compliance actually resulting in greater risk versus doing it a different way? Is there going to be irreversible harm that occurs through complying with the requirement? So one example we had here is, say you're conducting land disposal requirements for waste before placement in a landfill by treating it. That could, in this example, let's say that would actually result in greater risk to workers if they're dealing with really large debris that has to be moved by crane that was very, let's say, radioactive, very hot, so to speak, and every time a worker touched the debris, it essentially was greatly increasing their risk. So to help reduce the number of times workers had to deal with that very large radioactive debris, they could actually, instead of treating it before placing it in the landfill cell, they could actually place it directly in the cell, do the treatment in that landfill unit, and then proceed with disposal. So that is one example of when it would be greater risk to comply with the requirement as written versus using a different approach. We'll go to the next waiver, which is for technical impracticability. That's when compliance with such a requirement is technically impracticable from an engineering perspective. That means there are no existing nor innovative technologies that can reliably attain the AROR in question. So it doesn't have to be something that exists on the shelf right now. If there's promises that an innovative technology could be developed, that would need to be looked at. It's just not on-the-shelf technologies. So that has to be considered. Or if attainment would be illogical or infeasible from an engineering perspective, then that would help justify a technical impracticability waiver. One thing to keep in mind is that although cost can be considered, they're not the main factors that are considered. So it being expensive or a lot of money alone is not sufficient justification for a TI waiver. If it's highly excessive, and that's kind of a subjective phrase, right? Highly excessive cost, then you're considering it, but it really comes down to the feasibility of implementing that technology. So in the example here, we're looking at MCLs being waived in areas of highly contaminated, inaccessible pockets of liquid waste along fractures in deep bedrock. You know, EPA put out a report in 2012 that was a summary of all TI waivers issued between 1988 and 2011, And there were waivers issued for 85 NPL sites, 8 of which were at federal facilities. And out of those 91 waivers, 81 were for groundwater, and most often for waiving an MCL requirement. So if you're interested in getting that report, it's available online. It's a summary of TI waivers at NPL sites from 2012. All right, trying to get through this, and the time we have allotted for today, we'll go ahead and jump to the next slide, which is on the equivalent standard of performance waiver. And this is when the remedial action selected will attain a standard of performance that is equivalent to that required under the otherwise applicable standard, requirement, criteria, or limitation through use of another method or approach. So something that's just as good, like this is just as good. And then the second part of this is use of a particular design or operating standard is stipulated, but equivalent or better remedial results could be achieved using an alternative. So just as good or better is how I would summarize this waiver. But you want to be looking at things like the level of performance of the proposed action, its reliability, how long will it take to implement, and the degree of protection that the proposed action would offer over the one that's stipulated. So, for example, say there's a requirement to use a specific technology, but that requirement does not reflect the newest advancements in the field. And there might be a new, more efficient technology that provides a better degree of protection and reliability. In that case, it would likely make sense to pursue that equivalent standard of performance waiver because the proposed action offers more protection and a higher level of reliability. Going to our next waiver is the inconsistent application of state requirements. So Betsy talked a little bit about this already, and this is just looking at with respect to a state standard requirement criteria, if the state hasn't consistently applied it or haven't demonstrated they intend to consistently apply it, then should it be considered for this site? So you, in that case, you would look at things like the similarity of the site. What are the proportion of noncompliance cases in the state? Maybe there was a specific reason for noncompliance, and it makes sense that it would apply at your site. Or if there's intention to consistently apply those future requirements, or I should say requirements in the future, all of that would need to be considered. And I'm going to hand it over to Betsy to tell us what happens with ARARs post-fraud.
Okay, thank you, Emmy. Getting my controls back here. All right, so your rod is issued and your ARARs are all sewed up, and you've probably heard that ARARs are frozen once the rod is issued. However, there are circumstances when you may need to defrost your ARARs. So if a requirement that would be applicable or relevant and appropriate to the remedial action is promulgated after the rod is signed, the remedy must be evaluated in light of the new requirement to ensure that the remedy is still protective. To the extent that the remedy remains protective in light of any new information reflected in the requirement, the original ARARs remain frozen and nothing more needs to be done. However, if it is determined that the new requirement must be met in order for the remedy to be protective, the remedy must be modified to attain the requirement through an explanation of significant differences or a rod amendment. So for example, if a new standard for a site chemical is promulgated as a result of a revised toxicological analysis that indicates that the cleanup level selected for the chemical previously corresponds to a cancer risk of 10 to the minus 2 rather than 10 to the minus 5 as originally thought, the original remedy would have to be reevaluated, taking into account the new requirement, because the remedy may no longer be protective. So, and periodic considerations of the protectiveness of the remedy selected in a ROD are accomplished through 5-year reviews, which are required by CERCLA or program policy when hazardous substances remain on site above levels that would allow for unlimited use and unrestricted exposure, essentially residential use. During the 5-year review, the implementation and performance of a remedy is evaluated to determine whether it remains protective of human health and the environment. The technical assessment of a 5-year review addresses, among other things, whether the exposure assumptions, toxicity data, cleanup levels, and remedial action objectives used at the time of the remedy selection are still valid. This includes evaluating changes in ARARs that could affect protectiveness. So if through the five-year review process, it's determined that the ARARs documented in the ROD are no longer protective, then an ESD or ROD amendment will need to be issued to incorporate the newly promulgated ARAR. So, in summary, today, we've talked about the two different categories of ARARs, applicable and relevant appropriate requirements, and also TVCs and how they're different from ARARs, but that when they're selected in a remedy, they have to be complied with just like ARARs. We talked about the three types of ARARs, chemical-specific, location-specific, and action-specific. And just, I know there's a lot of layers of this. So, you know, an applicable requirement can be chemical, location, action-specific, and a relevant and appropriate requirement can be chemical, location, or action-specific. So that's just another layer. We talked about the difference between substantive requirements, which must be complied with as ARARs in on-site actions, and administrative requirements, which are not ARARs and do not need to be complied with on-site. And then the fact that both substantive and administrative requirements must be complied with off-site. I mean, in short, they're not ARARs, they're just applicable regulations off-site. We talked about how and where in the RIFS process, the proposed plan, and especially the ROD, that ARARs should be documented. We discussed ARARs identification and analysis and reviewed the federal statutes that are the common sources for ARARs. And finally, we reviewed the six statutory waivers that are available and may allow for noncompliance with an identified ARAR. So, if you have, we'll break for questions, and just I'm going to advance to the slide that has our contact information. So, if after the questions you haven't gotten your question answered, please feel free to contact either me or Emmy at our email address that's posted there, and we'll try to follow up with answers for all your questions. So I want to thank you very much for your attention today and your participation in the webinar. And now with, I guess we have a remaining 9 minutes maybe, we can answer whatever questions are out there.
Sure. So we have a lot, so I'm going to go through these as best as I can. I just wanted to just thank everybody for sending in all of their questions. So just generally speaking, there have been some questions about what counts, that whether would county or local policies be considered ARARs?
Sorry, I was on mute. No, they are not ARARs. But they could be TBCs if you think they're important. But they, like I said earlier, you may not recall, but the only local ordinances that I know of that are sort of generally ARARs are the ones are pretreatment requirements, a local ordinance that may be a pretreatment requirement that's rolled into a NPDES permit. You know, if you were on a CERCLA site, you wouldn't be getting the NPDES permit, but you still have to comply with the pretreatment requirement that would otherwise be applicable to that permit. But, okay. In general, no. In general, only TBCs.
Okay. And then we've had a couple questions about changes. So this one asks, if a rule changes, for example, a water standard becomes more stringent after the ROD is approved, is the ARAR updated in practice?
Well, that's it. You have to do the analysis to say, is my, is the ARAR that's included in the ROD still protective, or given the new information, which, you know, there's got to be some new scientific information, I would think, that's the background for the change in the rule. If that indicates that your analysis at the time of the ROD is no longer correct and that you need to update it to remain protective, that's the bottom line. You just have to assure that your remedy remains protective. So you have to update the ARAR in order to maintain protectiveness if that's the what your analysis indicates.
Okay. What about later on in your timeline? So can you add ARARs later in the whole cleanup process?
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing it like at your 5-year review, or if you come across something that you think ought to be added, you'd have to do either an explanation of significant differences or a ROD amendment. And although explanations of significant difference don't normally or necessarily require public notice, you might want to consider public notice when you're making a change like that, depending on the, you know, how large the change, the impact of the change is going to be, and for example, the dollar value.
Okay. We've had a number of questions that came in about differences or issues when state and federal regulations don't line up. So one of the attendees noted when there are procedural differences between state and federal regulations, but one procedure is not necessarily more stringent or protective than the other, they're just different. Do you have a sense of which regulation would win out in those types of situations?
Well, that would definitely be a site-specific analysis. And, you know, I would hesitate to say one way or the other, definitely. I mean, if they end up with the same final result, maybe the federal, but that is really a site-specific question. And I guess the answer is it could be either.
Okay. We did have a number of questions regarding citations. So specifically, people were wondering if you guys can cite things, just everything from, is there a citation for the 10 to the minus 6 level that shall be used for multiple contaminants? There are requests for citations for content that was listed on slide 57. Emmy, can you talk a little bit about what's in the participant manual? Do you have citations and references listed in that document?
You'll notice for the ARAR waivers, we did put those specific citations in on the slides. I believe slide 57, let me click there really quick. I'm not sure if the question is the citation as far as issuing an ESD or ROD amendment if ARARs are changed, or if it's in reference to having to issue a ROD amendment if you're pursuing a TI waiver. So if you have some questions like that, instead of just pointing you to the NCP, I would say EPA's 1999 ROD ESD and ROD amendment guidance is really helpful for pointing out the citations, like why is it required that you would do a proposed plan? Why is it required to do that comment period for a TI waiver? That is a very easy to digest guidance that will point to the citations that you're likely looking for.
Okay.
Yeah, and just that's a great overall answer. And for the person who wanted to know about 10 to the minus 6, it's 300.430E, letter E, number 2A. And then under that, it's within that, but E, 300.430E2A, it's under sub number 2. And that describes both the toxicants and the carcinogens.
Okay. So a number of people are asking if there's sort of a checklist or a bank of laws and regulations that would sort of serve as a starting point for a collection of ARARs. So they're wondering if that type of a collection exists somewhere.
Yeah, a good place to look is the 1988 guidance, the CERCLA Compliance with Other Laws manual. It has a lot of assistance with that. It's a two-part guidance, very comprehensive. And some of it's outdated, but it's basically all, you know, that's an excellent starting point.
Okay.
And there is a Q&A fact sheet that complements the Part 1 and Part 2 manual, and we tried to structure this course based on that fact sheet. So really tried to keep it in line with the existing guidance.
Okay. We have had a number of questions asking you to circle back on the error that you highlighted earlier. So someone was wondering if you could specifically indicate where the typo or error was in the participant manual.
Oh, gosh, I don't have the manual open, but it's in the discussion of under the slide for where removals are discussed. Let me see.
I believe it was slide 7 and slide 33, where we accidentally said It should read that removal actions, AORs for removal actions should be implemented or complied with to the extent practicable, but our typo was including the phrase and remedial actions. So that and remedial actions doesn't go in there. It's just to the extent practicable refers to removal actions and their AORs.
Okay. And someone had chimed in that on slide 33 that they think a similar error might be there, that there's a reference to say removal instead of remedial. So what I will do is we'll be collecting all of these comments and sharing that with the instructors. So any revision to the participant manual, we will take a look at everything that you all have chimed in with, and then if we are able to pull together an updated version, we will post and email all of you so that you now have the latest and greatest and corrected version. So I just wanted to express our thanks and gratitude for everybody looking at that at such fine detail. The other thing that I did wanted to point out is that we're now reaching our scheduled end time, so I don't want to keep people too much longer, but there were a number of site-specific or what appear to be very site-specific scenarios that were brought up in the queue. And so before we close things out today, I wanted to circle back to our instructors. If they have site-specific questions or they want to know, in my situation, this is what we're dealing with, can they reach out to the two of you for follow-on questions?
This is Emmy. Yeah. I'll just answer. I think we're always wanting to make ourselves available, but honestly, when it comes to those site-specific questions, we can chime in, but those really have to be determined through the site project team in consultation with your own regional council or your own legal team. So we won't, you know, when it comes to site-specific, we often, as headquarters people, push back that you should work through the region to answer that question. But if it's content from the course or just wanting to delve into understanding material better, we would be happy to help with that.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, let me go ahead and walk through just a few quick closing reminders. I wanted to, first of all, thank the nearly 290 people that we had on live for today's broadcast. We do, as we noted earlier, have copies of the presentation material already posted and available on the seminar resources page. So you'll find things such as that sort of webinar tracker spreadsheet that you can use to keep track of when you've either attended or replayed the sessions. You can download the participant manual and find other resources there. Contact information for our presenters and organizers is also posted there, so you can certainly reach out to us if you have follow-on questions. And I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're looking for a participation certificate, and again, if you're trying to complete the entire series, you'll need one of those. You can get one of those after you submit feedback. So it's very critical, though, that you do two things when you're filling out that feedback form. Please be sure to fill in your email address correctly and check the box at the bottom of that form certifying you are here for the whole delivery or replayed the entire recording. If you don't check that box, we won't generate a certificate. So as soon as you submit that form, you check the box, you should then immediately be able to download or print out a certificate for your own records. While we do not offer PDHs or CDUs, our participants are oftentimes able to document their participation with the registration email, the materials, and the certificate, and then get credit with their own institutions. So I encourage you to follow the link over to the feedback form. I've placed it right in the Q&A for easy reference as well. If you happen to be a lucky person who's replayed the entire 2 hours of today's session, you can still follow those links to the seminar feedback form. We do welcome your input, both in the content that was presented as well as our manner of delivering. And so with that, I'll remind everybody that today's session was recorded just like the others in the series. You'll automatically receive an email with information on how to play back today's session on demand. And I want to thank both of our instructors for taking time out of their busy schedules to share their expertise. I hope that you all found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. I know I certainly did. And I want to thank everybody for actively participating in our live broadcasts. We'll go ahead and formally conclude our session, and I hope to see you on a future webinar.